1290 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger. House Speaker Mike Johnson says he's invited Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address a joint session of Congress. Johnson said so during a keynote address today at the Israeli Embassy's Independence Day reception. At the White House tonight, a state dinner to honor Kenyan President William Ruto and his wife. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell got a firsthand look at the tornadoes that slammed Iowa.
And in Adair County alone, we had 153 major destroyed homes. Montgomery had 8, Polk County 26, Story County 15, for a total of 202. We've had a lot of destruction and damage across the state.
Governor Kim Reynolds has expanded the disaster declaration to 32 counties. After a passenger died and several others were injured during severe turbulence, Singapore Airlines says it will no longer serve hot drinks or meals when the seatbelt sign is on. This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The Wisconsin delegates and alternates to the Republican National Convention include two people who served as fake electors in 2020. Pam Travis and Bob Spindell signed documents to cast Wisconsin's electoral votes for Donald Trump, even though Joe Biden had won. Hunters and fishers in Wisconsin are keeping a close eye on work on the 2024 federal farm bill. Aaron Sandquist with Pheasants Forever says the bill needs strong private land conservation protection.
We have a lot of needs in states like Minnesota and Wisconsin, particularly in the prairie areas, and private land habitat provided by the Farm Bill, like CRP, is critically important.
Advocates say 40 million people would lose access to hunting and fishing opportunities without the Conservation Reserve program. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Hi, this is Jim Schmidt, your former mayor of Green Bay. You know, I've always cared about local issues. I still do. Join me on my new show, Lean Local, here on WGBW. I'll interview community leaders and elected officials, discuss the economy and development projects, and we'll talk about the future of education here in Greater Green Bay. As they say, all politics is local. So join me for Lean Local, Sunday at 1 p.m. on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 WGBW.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Nikki Haley. Nikki Haley says she's going to vote for Trump. Of course she's going to. They sure do fall in line, don't they? And look, no surprise. If you've been following the trial, which I have not, but I have been following the circus outside and all of the Republicans who go make the pilgrimage to kiss the ring and then wear the costume. It's been cute watching all the guys show up in their Trump suits. Very, very interesting. And look, this is what they do. They fall in line. And I say this all the time. Republicans fall in line. Democrats fall in love with candidates who aren't going to win. And we throw a lot of resources at them and don't really build for the future. Hope that changes. But today, my mind went to this idea, and it took me back to 2015 when we did our civil rights tour. Part of the program, we went throughout the southern U.S., and we went to all the places that treated black people really poorly and now have tourist attractions. It's kind of like, hey, look how bad we were. So they did a nice job of history. Because understand, the reason that we did the tour, I wanted to do something for the radio and educate the broader populace, but it was more about my daughter. She came home from school one day, said, you know, what'd you learn? Learned about Rosa Parks. Oh, yeah, what'd you learn? She was tired. She was tired. And look, we went to the Rosa Parks Museum there at Troy University. Incredible. If you're ever in the neighborhood, by all means. But we, while in Mississippi, this idea of Freedom Summer was something that got a lot of attention. 1964, you got the Voting Rights Act that passes. Now it's, hey, how do we get this moving? So in what, you know, can only be described as a desperate need to address and dismantle the systematic racism that had suppressed voters in the South forever, just about, especially Mississippi, you had people who converged on that state who wanted to make change. My mind immediately went to Hezekiah Watkins, a guy we met while we were in at Jackson State University, who he and his friends were just seeing what was going on at the Greyhound bus station. And the Freedom Riders were coming in on the bus. And he got pushed. He says pushed. His friends say he just momentum. But he got rounded up, 13-year-old boy, rounded up, taken to jail, thrown in parchment prison for several days with a murderer and a rapist and just horrible, horrible things. But that idea of Freedom Summer was on my mind today. And, you know, I started thinking about all of the organizing by groups like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and the Congress for Racial Equality, CORE, all of these groups who, you know, were moving, and the people who were there. You know, while we were doing this tour, we learned about, you know, people in history that I never learned about. Bob Moses, for instance, was the political director for SNCC. John Lewis, who became a congressman icon, but he was one of the, you know, he's the chairman of SNCC. Fannie Lou Hamer, her name came up as one of the activists and leaders of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. They had a whole segment, a black portion of the Democratic Party who went to the National Convention. She gave powerful testimony at the National Convention and to talk about the struggles that blacks had in the South. And of course, you know, we learned about James Cheney and Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwirmer, who were murdered because they had the audacity to want to help people to register to vote. Ella Baker, who was, you know, another one, you know, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. You know, there were so many people that we learned about that our history books don't want us to know about. So as I thought about Freedom Summer, which again, you know, 1964, you've got all of this activity. But the idea, the bedrock of all this is to get blacks registered to vote, to get establishment of schools, freedom schools, they called them, so that you could educate and empower people to participate in democracy, created the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, challenged the legitimacy of the all-white Mississippi delegation. Because understand, Mississippi was a Democratic state back then. So when you had these black voters saying, look, we want to take over the Democratic Party, and they kind of have in a way, especially there, what you did is you had this kind of this explosion of activism. And what did they want? What did they accomplish? They went out and they registered voters. They got people politically active. Did they meet all of their goals? No, they didn't. And you go through and you look at the things that they were able to accomplish. Moreover, brought national awareness and legislative change. You get the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that comes through. You get a lot of this activity. You got the Civil Rights Act, you got the Voting Rights Act, you got all of this stuff happening. And why do I talk about it now? Because it's kind of important that we learn this history. And I know there's out there, you know, we can't learn that history. That's bad. You know, especially in a place like Florida. But understanding what things were like, the people who fought the battles, and the legacy of activism and the courage of people to stand up and fight really what was an overwhelmingly racist and systematically unempowering system. And this idea to fight for racial justice, to fight for a future, economic equality, opportunity for people. You know, again, I keep coming back to this moment, landmark event, not only achieved the goals of getting people out and registering to vote and all that stuff, but had this lasting effect and this motivating effect on the civil rights movement and society as a whole. So my mind, again, now understand where I'm at in this. I'm thinking about all of these images that I saw in these museums of people burning, of crosses burning, of death and destruction and pain and misery and suffering and all of this. And I understand, you know, my mind immediately, Freedom Summer, 1964, man, it elicits a response from people who understand history. Having gone through and seen these things, and so it elicits a response from me. So when I see that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is calling this summer Freedom Summer and has instructed his Department of Transportation to only use the colors red, white, and blue when they light up the bridges at night, because evidently the history has been that, you know, from Memorial Day to Labor Day, colorful. It's, you know, it's a celebration. It's summer. You know, it's Sunshine State. You know, they do all this stuff. They illuminate the bridges with a colorful array of lights to mark the holidays, to mark awareness events, all kinds of stuff. Now, between May 27th and September 2nd, there will be no other colors. Just red, white, and blue in Freedom Summer. And now understand, according to the Transportation Secretary, Jared Perdue, he put out on Twitter, as Floridians prepare for Freedom Summer, Florida's bridges will follow suit, illuminating in red, white, and blue from Memorial Day to Labor Day. Thanks to the leadership of Governor Ron DeSantis, Florida continues to be the freest state in the nation. Except you can't use any other colors but red, white, blue, but we're free! Now, do you think, and this is where my mind went, do you think that they're just stupid? And, well, Freedom Summer, we like the word freedom. And it is summer. You know how much we like the word freedom. And it is going to be summer. They naturally go together. Freedom Summer. Do you think that's how it came up? Or do you think that they really knew what they were doing? That they're trying to overwrite history, to rewrite that bit of history of saying, no, Freedom Summer is about bridges and red, white, and blue. Not the red that bled in the streets. Not the pain and suffering that happened for a race of people in this country at the hands of another race. No, can't talk about that because that would be bad. Certainly can't have it in our schools. And remember, the freest state in the country. In the freest state in the country, you don't get to learn about actual history. No. We're just going to give you our, shall I say, whitewashed version. And I got to tell you, you know, as a parent, as a citizen, this kind of stuff really bothers me. Because, you know, look, I was not presented this stuff in my education. We sought this kind of stuff out. The history that we learned by actually being in places and seeing the aftermath has stuck with us. So for me, it's a disgrace to one, say that they're the freest state in the country, and then say, well, we can only use our colors, and then to use those words. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back.
Thank you. We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, every day I hear my red hat friends tell me how, you know, Joe Biden's stealing the election. You know, we lived through 2020, right? All of my red hat friends were saying Joe Biden's learned coding. And, you know, in the basement, he was doing the hacking and he did all this stuff. And it's all about, you know, the elections are rigged and they're stolen, you know. And I had a conversation today with a friend who I said, look, you know, Republicans have done a masterful job over the decades of rigging elections. Now, they've done it through, you know, technical means. You go back to 2000, the hanging chads, the voting while black, the choice point, all the stuff that we saw happen then. We didn't see riots in the streets. So the question becomes, what happens if the Stop the Steal people decide that they want to steal? And here to share some thoughts on what that could look like, I've asked our good friend Hamilton Nolan to come talk with us. Hamilton's a contributing writer over at In These Times. He's also got a fabulous Substack page, How Things Work. I highly suggest subscribing to that. He's got a new piece out, What Will You Do If the Election is Stolen? Hamilton, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, man. Love to be here.
So I read this headline and I'm going, you know, did you put on a red hat? Because, you know, we're supposed to believe the only people who care about stolen elections are the MAGA folks who are standing in line waiting to see Trump and, you know, all that. You know, what happens if Trump doesn't concede?
I mean, it's worth thinking about. You know, I guess at this point, it's pretty clear that, you know, he still hadn't conceded the 2020 election, which has been litigated to hell and back. I mean, and reported all the way out, top to bottom. We know for a fact there was no fraud in 2020. He still hasn't conceded it. And I guess, you know, even kind of more worrying than the fact that he personally keeps saying that he won is the fact that now you can see the Republican Party gathering around behind him and backing that that kind of big lie going into the 2024 election. And you've seen like this procession of Republicans in Congress giving interviews and refusing to say that they'll accept the election results. So it's not hard to see a scenario where Trump could refuse to concede and the Republican Party could rally around him and it could provoke a serious political crisis. So, you know, the most basic point I was trying to make in the piece was like, it's time for everybody to think about what you would do in the event that happens and it goes to the Supreme Court and something bad happens at the Supreme Court.
Well, because the Supreme Court's crazy. I mean, I look at someone like Sam Alito, who we were just talking, who we're going to be talking about here in a little bit. And my mind goes, I don't have any faith in our Supreme Court. So if all of these things play the way I've heard them war gamed out, which means the House of Representatives gets to decide. We go back to the state thing and all that. You know, Trump wins.
Yeah, I mean, in 2020, you know, we had a version of this, right? We lived through a version of this in 2020, and the 2020 version was kind of a crazy, frenetic, last minute, ad hoc version of Donald Trump trying to just magically gin up a victory for himself that didn't work. And, you know, some people took that as a sign that our institutions held up in the face of Trump. But, you know, in the past 4 years, the underlying situation has gotten worse. You know, there are multiple Republicans who voted to certify the election in 2020 who are now already refusing to say that they'll accept the election results in 2024. So like the political base of the Republican Party is going to unite behind Trump, you know, and it is a it is not a far-fetched scenario. And I think that at this point, you know, 5 months away from the election, it's not necessary for everybody to have like a specific guess that this will or won't happen. You know, it may happen, it may not happen, but it's enough to be like the pieces are enough pieces are in place to make it plausible enough that this could happen.
Yeah.
That we seriously need to have a plan in place about what we'll do if it does happen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who's going to win. I fear, you know, judging at some of the things that I see, I fear Trump has a really good shot at being reelected. That worries me. But I believe I can guarantee that if he loses, that every bit of whining, every bit of the election was stolen, every gimmick that is out there will be tried. So you're right. We do need to have some kind of a what if. So what are you suggesting? I mean, you know, for average everyday people, what is the way forward then?
Yeah, I mean, if you think of a scenario where he actually was able to steal it, for example, by getting a favorable Supreme Court ruling or other shenanigans on the state level, I think that, you know, the biggest thing that I suggested in my post is that you have a general strike at that point, you know, and I have no doubt that there would be street protests if something like that happened. I'm sure there'd be street protests in many cities across the country. But if you planned a serious general strike, and this is an example of a scenario where we could actually plan a general strike or a potential general strike in advance and have that as a tool. And it is for the absolute worst case scenario we can imagine, which is the literal end of democracy in America. So I would say this is the most conservative possible reason that you could plan a general strike. It is something that organizations like the AFL-CIO could start planning now just to potentially get unions on board in advance and saying, look, this scenario may not play out. Everything may be fine. But in the event that this does play out, let's get all the unions on board in advance and say that we are going to have a general strike in order to demonstrate that you can't govern America under a dictatorship. And this, by the way, is something that the Vermont AFL-CIO tried to sort of float in 2020, in November of 2020, when Trump was refusing to concede the election. The Vermont AFL-CIO tried to sort of start an ad hoc group, labor group, to commit to doing a general strike if he in fact stole the election. And the national AFL-CIO shot them down on that. But, you know, it is not a crazy idea. And it is really a scenario where you can see the labor movement stepping up to lead the country and to be that tool that could put a stop to the ability to govern America under a dictatorship. You know, here's a chance for the labor movement to step up in the event this terrible thing actually happens.
No, or it just you know, basic self-preservation. You know, we know when you have dictator types take over, the labor movement is generally one of the first places they go to crush any kind of uprising or any kind of activism. So it would be in their interest to at least talk proactively about something like this, no?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously a national general strike is not something you can pull off at the drop of a hat, right? I mean, and again, like, people talk about let's do a general strike for all types of stuff. I mean, and there's a lot of people at labor who are sick of hearing the word general strike because every time anybody has a gripe, they're like, we need to do a general strike. But here we're talking about the actual end of American democracy, potentially. And in the event this most extreme scenario happened, this is something that the AFL-CIO and other unions can plan out in advance just to get tacit approval from major national unions in advance to say, look, if this wild scenario happens, let's all agree, we're gonna get on the same page, we're gonna do a general strike. And you can imagine unions in the labor movement leading a general strike that pulled in, you know, it's not just gonna be union members, you know, it's not just gonna be 15 million union members in America. If something this extreme were to happen, unions could lead and it's easy to imagine tens of millions of other Americans coming and joining in also. So a general strike could really paralyze the country and stop them from governing under a dictatorship in this scenario, you know, but yes, it's something we need to talk about in advance and kind of get the basic plan worked out in advance. There's really no reason not to. It's like disaster planning. Yeah. You know, I don't know if a hurricane's going to hit Florida this year, but at least you should have a plan in place in case it does.
No, you're absolutely right. But you know, it's like negotiating contracts. You know, you put the arrow of the strike in your quiver, hoping you never need it. But it's always there. Kind of makes you feel like, hey, I got somewhere to go to if we have to. So it makes sense to me. But let me ask you the other side of this, because I look at my union. I've been a Teamster for more than 35 years. My union right now is playing footsie with Trump. You know, they're going out and, you know, we're having an election right now to see if the union's going to endorse Trump as if he's just a normal candidate who has, you know, normal views. The labor movement is not a monolith. You know, how do you see getting this together? I mean, you know, there doesn't seem to be that kind of unity push yet, or am I not seeing something?
No, I mean, look, obviously, there's a lot of union members in America who will vote for Trump. You know, not the majority, but a significant number. And so it's important to emphasize, right? If we talk about planning or pulling something like this together, this is not a general strike against Trump winning the election. You know, I sincerely hope Trump does not win the election. I think it'd be awful for America and for unions if Trump wins the election. But if he wins the election fair and square, he wins.
Right.
You know, what we're talking about is a stolen election. We are talking about a scenario where he loses the election and then succeeds in stealing it. Right through shenanigans.
Well, no, look, you know, Hamilton, the one thing I can guarantee is he's going to lose the popular vote. That's going to happen.
That's the Electoral College. That's a whole other issue.
He is going to lose the popular vote. There's no question. What those handful of states and handful of voters decide on that day of what this looks like and how it's manipulated. And again, I keep looking at states that are doing a lot of, you know, really shady kind of stuff to keep people from being able to vote, which is why I say, look, you know, Republicans have done a masterful job of rigging elections before they even start. And I don't know if we talk enough about that, but what do you say to the argument that, you know, by bringing this up, that, it, you know, the Republicans could steal the election, that we're, you know, engaging in the same kind of thing that Republicans are engaging in, that we can't get a free and fair election.
I don't think that's true. Look, if Joe Biden steals the election, we can also have a general strike. That's fine with me. You know, we're talking about preserving democracy. And look, we were all around in 2016, you know, Trump won the election in 2016. He lost the popular vote, but he won the election according to our laws, you know. And in 2016, I was crushed that he won the election, but I wasn't like he stole it. You know, he won it according to the laws of the United States. So that scenario is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a guy who has not stopped for the past 4 years talking about how he won the last election, which he didn't, which we all know he didn't, including Republicans, and who is already talking about how he can't lose this election, and who is already giving a million hints about how if he loses, it's going to be fraud, you know? And we see what the Supreme Court is like. We see what Republicans in Congress are like. I mean, that you don't need any more hints than we already have on the table. This, again, is disaster preparedness. If something horrible goes down, let's start thinking about it now. And if we don't, we're idiots. You know,
I'm right there with you. I'm trying to what the right way to explain, to put this out there, because, you know, I often sit back and go, I'm amazed that there are no profiles in courage on the Republican side of the aisle, that they've all just kind of fallen in line. And look, Nikki Haley has now said she's voting for Trump. I look at all these people who are going outside of the courtroom, all dressed in the Trump uniform of the blue and the red tie, and they all look like, you know, little carbon copy clones. I'm struggling with just how easy it seemed that the Republican Party just fell in line, and that we're really talking about an end of our democracy. I mean, does that weigh on you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it kind of exposes the moral bankruptcy at the core of that. And look, I don't think that is necessarily confined to the Republican Party. I think Trump is bringing that out to the fore and showing it to the world on the Republican side, I think there's plenty of Democrats who are probably equally morally bankrupt if it came right down to it, and would do the same thing, unfortunately. But I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, to watch these Republicans debase themselves, including a lot of Republicans who said a lot of bad things about Trump and who now turn around and deny it and get on their knees and kiss his ass. And I mean, it's people who will do anything for power. And it, you know, it's not just an American phenomenon, right? This has happened in many countries and many times throughout history. People who will do anything for power, including horrible things. And that's how we get strong men, and that's how we get fascist leaders. And it's happened many times before, and I hope that America learns a lesson from
it. I'm right there with you. And I agree with you. We should be planning for what if, and hopefully these conversations, hopefully your piece will spark some conversations at the higher level of the labor movement, and maybe we get something that moves us in this direction. But Hamilton, I appreciate the time. As always, good stuff.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Hamilton Nolan, contributing writer over at In These Times. Check out his Substack page, How Things Work, and you can take a look at this article on what will you do if the election is stolen. That's an excellent question. Want to hear your thoughts. What would you do? What's the plan going forward? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. In the overnight, we expect skies to turn clear. We'll have light winds, and by morning, temperatures in the middle 50s. On your Friday, showers and thunderstorms becoming likely, a mix of clouds and sunshine with highs reaching the lower 70s. Currently 62 degrees.
Matt Mayer on air.
Dr. Karen Tamarius, she's a political psychiatrist, and we're talking about how to talk to people with which we do not agree.
Think of the mind as a rider on an elephant. The conscious part is the rider, and the emotional part is the elephant. If you want the person to change their mind, you need to talk with the elephant, not the rider.
Matt Mayer on air, weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to ask the question, what is it with conservatives and flags? I mean, do they have to stake the flag in the ground so everyone knows just how bad they are? No, look, in my neighborhood, I know a bunch of people. They've still got the Hillary for prison signs out. They got that yellow flag with the snake that's there. They got the F. Biden flags, you know, the good God-fearing Christian folks who believe in family values with the F. Biden flags out front. But all of this stuff, and look, and I'm like, okay, you know, be an idiot. At least we know who you are. But someone sitting on the Supreme Court? Really? We're just now finding out flags flying in front of Alito's home and vacation spots. And here to share some thoughts on what does this mean? Why? Why would a Supreme Court justice put this appeal to heaven flag out, or otherwise known as the pine tree flag, in front of his New Jersey home, or you know, the upside down flag after Biden took office? I don't know, but here to share some thoughts, I've asked Ian Miller to come talk with us. Ian's a senior correspondent over at Vox. He's got a new piece out, the Republican Party's Man Inside the Supreme Court. Ian, thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much, Rick.
So what is this with the flag thing, man? I mean, look, I work with a bunch of people who fly the flag off their pickup truck, and it's one flag or another. It's a you know, a Rambo-looking Trump, or it's an F. Biden, or it's... And I get that. Okay, you're trying to express yourself. You need to be seen. I get it. But come on, man. This is Sam Alito sitting on the most powerful court in the land. Does he really need to differentiate himself from his neighbors?
Yeah, it's such a bizarre thing to do. We ask basically nothing of our Supreme Court justices. You know, they're appointed for life. They can write whatever they want in their opinions. There's basically nothing we can do to them if their opinions are wacko and partisan. And believe me, Alito's opinions are wacko and partisan. The only thing we ask of them is that they have the most, the thinnest reed of plausible deniability about their partisanship, you know, that they don't go out and actively campaign for a candidate, that they don't run around screaming, I am a Democrat or I am a Republican. That is the only thing we ask. You know, Sammy Lillo, you had one job and he was unable to do this one thing. Like all we asked of him is like, if you want to hoist a flag on a flagpole outside of your home, make it normal. You know, make it like a right side up American flag, for example. You know, we're not going to stop you from writing crazy opinions. We're not going to stop you from trying to influence elections from your seat on the Supreme Court. All we ask is that you show slightly more restraint than the person who has 14 Trump bumper stickers on the back of their car.
Are we sure he doesn't? I guess, does anyone take a picture of the back of his car? But no, here's the thing. And maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's that one thing. You know, like a kid, you tell a kid not to do something and they're fixated on that one thing. They can do everything else, but it's that one thing you said no. It's that forbidden fruit. Could this be it? He just feels the need to express himself, you know, like, you know, bursting out of the closet with upside down flags and appeals to heaven flags.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly could be like, you know, after Trump and, you know, after January 6th and now all the norms are gone, he's just decided to, you know, to let his freak flag fly.
In more ways than one.
The other thing here, though, is like, I don't know that we know how long this has been going on. Like, I have covered Alito for, you know, almost his entire career as a Supreme Court justice. I just wrote this piece, The Republicans Party's Man Inside the Supreme Court, talking about how he always, always, always does the most partisan thing. And this is an update of a piece I wrote 10 years ago that was called The Most Partisan Justice of All, which is about how Alito always does what the Republican Party wants in contentious cases. So he has always been this way. I think one thing that has changed beyond Trump destroying all the norms is that journalists are now more interested in covering Supreme Court justices the same way they cover any other politician. You know, I mean, there were a bunch of Thomas scandals back in 2011. I covered a bunch of them.
Right.
That, like, you know, they were a thing in 2011 for like maybe a week or two. And then that news cycle faded and everyone forgot about it. You know, a lot of the stuff that Politico just won a Pulitzer for was just elaborations on stuff that I and other reporters covered in 2011. And the stuff that I wrote in 2011 was elaborations of stuff that was covered in 2004. This stuff has been around for a really long time. It's not hidden. What has changed is that I think after ProPublica had so much success in exposing so much of the corruption behind Clarence Thomas, a bunch of outlets have decided, well, maybe we should do more of this sort of investigative reporting into the justices. And now we're discovering things that, you know, for all we know, Alito has had a Gadsden flag or, you know, a GOP flag or whatever other weird symbol. For all we know, he's had that in front of his home for the last 15 years. And we're just now learning about it because journalists are starting to do this kind of reporting.
Yeah, someone just now cared. And the neighbors, you know, they didn't mind because, well, they probably had it flying as well. And this is the weird kind of the world that we're in, because like you said, these are supposed to be people who are above all of this fray. These are the people who make the big decisions. And yet, the partisanship, it is what it is. I mean, and he is who he was supposed to be. I go back to, and I think we talked about it before we came on air, that, you know, Harriet Meyer was Bush's first appointment, and I said, hey, you know, maybe we take her. You know, she might be pliable. maybe we go in this direction, because she wasn't very good as Bush's lawyer. She didn't go to an Ivy League school. She wasn't in that kind of, you know, birth to right now kind of world that grooms these people to not have to be influenced. They already know what they're supposed to believe.
Right.
And Democrats did a really good job of taking her down. And this is what you got.
Yeah. No, I mean, in retrospect, I was a law student at the time. So it's not like I had a lot of influence. But I remember I put on an event at my law school about the Myers nomination called Cronyism and the Supreme Court. Because, you know, the line against Harriet Myers is that she was Bush's lawyer. She didn't seem particularly qualified for the job. She got it because she was close with, you know, the guy who was in charge of the hiring process. And in retrospect, I mean, man, Democrats should have just raced to confirm Harriet. Like, they should have held the confirmation vote that day. You know, and if we had known that Alito was going to be the alternative, I think, like, that's what Democrats would have tried to do. Because, you know, this guy has been like, well, he was like this when he was on the Third Circuit. When he was a lower court judge, you may remember a little case called Planned Parenthood v. Casey. That was the 1992 decision, which said that Roe v. Wade is still good law. The lower court judge who wrote the opinion, you know, the author of the lower court opinion in Planned Parenthood v. Casey was Sam Alito. And he wrote an opinion as a lower court judge that would have basically nuked Roe.
Yeah.
He was the one who essentially got reversed by the Supreme Court when it decided to leave Roe on the books. So this guy has always been this way.
Yeah. And in your piece you wrote, I found this piece interesting. You said Alito, a judge with no theory of the Constitution or no insight into how judges should read ambiguous law beyond his driving belief that his team should always win. You said this is a perfect fit for what the Republican Party has become in the age of Trump. And, you know, truer words not spoken. I mean, this is, it doesn't matter what the law said yesterday. We're making it up to fit today. This is 1984 right. On steroids.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm really happy that Alito is displaying these partisan flags and, like, just leaving no doubt about who he is. Because, you know, I've been on the Alito beat for a really long time trying to get people to understand just how partisan this guy is. And the way that I've made the argument, you know, in my recent piece, like, I point to a study that shows, like, if you look at all of the – someone did a study where they looked at all of the cases that Alito has heard in the last 10 years involving the question of standing. You know, standing is the question of whether or not you are allowed to bring a federal lawsuit in the first place. And what the data shows is that Alito voted in favor of conservative litigants 100% of the time. If you're a conservative litigant, 100% of the time you said you have standing. And if you're a liberal litigant, 100% of the time you said you don't have standing. So, like, you know, I tell that to a lawyer, I tell that to a law professor, and they say, yeah, that's pretty bad. But, like, I tell that to most ordinary people, and, like, I think most ordinary people's reaction is, wait, what's standing? Like, you know, it's kind of an esoteric thing. So, like, he's been communicating just what a partisan hack he is to lawyers for as long as I have been covering him. But now he's finally communicating it in a way that, like, doesn't use lawyer speak. You know, he's communicating in a way that normal people can understand. And I think that's great. Because, you know, this guy's one of the most powerful people in the United States of America. We're supposed to be a democracy, and that means that ordinary voters should know who this guy is.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and this is where I'm gonna. You're the legal expert here, and I'm just a truck driver. Do I want a Supreme Court full of, you know, people wearing NASCAR jackets? Do I want people who are we know before the case comes up that they're bought and paid for in this ideological track and they will never move and that they're always looking to punish the other side? I mean, is that good for democracy? Is that good for our system?
Well, I mean, of course not. I mean, we want judges who do their best to apply the law. You know, we want judges who don't come up through a farm system like the Federalist Society, where, like, they are all trained to march in lockstep on certain issues. We don't want judges who, like, could, you know, get up there with a NASCAR jacket with all their sponsors on it. But if we have a judge like that, I want them to wear the jacket. I don't want there to be any doubt about who they are. Yeah.
So let me ask you this, because we've seen Clarence Thomas. There's been a lot of you know stuff around him in Harlan Crow, a lot of, you know, the RV, the busts, you know, all kinds of stuff, all kind of gifts, all kind of benevolence from rich people because they like him. He's a nice guy. He tells funny jokes and stories. Anything like that for Alito? I mean, I know when Antonin Scalia was alive, he used to complain all the time about how low the pay was for Supreme Court justices. Is this a, hey, you know, we're, you know, in order to keep food on the table, roof over our head, we got to sell some decisions.
Yeah, I mean, there has been one story. I mean, ProPublica had a story that shortly after Alito was confirmed, a billionaire named Paul Singer apparently took him on a very expensive fishing trip. You may have heard about the $1,000 bottle of wine that they drank on this fishing trip.
Someone was going to be in that seat anyway, Ian.
Yeah, I just have to ask, I've been fishing before. And I've never thought of it. I guess I've been deep sea fishing before. That's kind of expensive, but I've never thought of it as an activity that could cost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. Fishing has always struck me as a fairly working man's activity that everyone can engage in. And apparently Alito found a way to do it the billionaire's way.
Yeah, he had someone else do it while he watched.
Yeah, but maybe. But I don't think that the story with someone like Alito or Thomas is a story of someone is giving them money to hand down a certain decision. You know, I don't think that their decisions are driven by corruption.
No,
I think that their decisions are driven by something much worse. You know, the nice thing about a corrupt person is if you're bribing someone to do a terrible thing, and you stop bribing them, they stop doing the terrible thing.
Right.
Because they're no longer getting compensated for what they're being paid to do. Thomas and Alito do this stuff for free. You know, they are true believers. They were put there because they don't need another incentive. I mean, the billionaires love them for doing it. They're willing to lavish gifts on them. I think, you know, especially with Thomas, there's some indication that maybe one of the reasons why the billionaires were giving him so many of these gifts is because they liked his decisions and they didn't want him to leave. Because, you know, if you're a former Supreme Court justice, you could just make tons of money. You can probably find a law firm to pay you $1 million a year just so they can have you on the masthead and say hey, come hire our law firm. You might get a former Supreme Court justice advising you. If Thomas likes nice things, one way that you can keep him from cashing in and getting a lot of nice things is to give him the nice things while he stays on his current job.
Right.
But I don't think he's handing down the cases he's handing down because he needs to be paid to do it.
He really
believes this stuff.
No, I'm right there with you. Look, and that's why I said, you know, with Harriet Myers, you know, it was good to have someone who wasn't groomed from birth to that very moment, which, you know, the Kavanaughs and the Alitos and all these people, I believe, have been. From the time they were very young, they were groomed to nobody has to ask what they believe. They already know what they believe. That's why what you're saying is absolutely spot on. So last kind of question I've got for you, because look, you know, Alito's bad. There's another crop of bad here as well. I mean, I look at the Trump appointments and I think they're ideologically driven. I think they're going to be there for a long time. I think they're going to reshape this country in very negative and bad ways. How are they any different than Alito? And are we expecting them to be in the same vein?
Yeah. I mean, I think the short answer is it depends on the Trump appointee. So, you know, Alito, I think, is unique, at least on the Supreme Court, in that there's no other justice who just mechanically does what the Republican Party wants in the way that Alito does. You know, Thomas will say, look, I have this overarching philosophy. It's called originalism. And sure, originalism is designed to always to reach conservative results in most cases. But, you know, just last week, there was a case where a lower court had declared the entire Consumer Financial Protection Bureau unconstitutional, which is nutty. And Thomas wrote a perfectly good originalist opinion saying, yeah, that's nuts. Alito dissented. Alito was the one who said, like, I don't care what the law says. I'm just going to find a way to get to the result that, you know, that benefits my team. If you dig into the lower courts, you're starting to see a lot of Alitos. You know, think of Eileen Cannon, you know, this woman who's assigned to Trump's stolen documents case, who's acted like a member of his defense team. You know, think of Matthew Kaczmarek, this guy down in Texas who's become this rubber stamp where when Republicans want a court order, they go to Matthew Kaczmarek's courtroom and he gives them pretty much whatever they want. So, you know, you do have a lot of Alito-like judges who are coming up through the lower courts. And what I worry about is that if we get a second Trump term, you know, the one thing that made the first Trump term survivable is that Trump didn't really know what he was doing.
Right.
You know, he didn't know anyone in Washington. He didn't know who his loyalists were. He didn't really know what he wanted to accomplish. And he didn't know how to accomplish it. And so, like, a lot of the judges he nominated were people who were very, very conservative, but they were there to advance the Federalist Society's agenda. They were there to advance Leonard Leo's, you know, they were there to advance someone else's goals. The reason why so many of his cabinet secretaries are now denouncing him is because he didn't know who to appoint. So we appointed people, you know, who would later look at him and turn up their nose and say, yeah, that guy was really scary and corrupt. Now he knows what he is doing. You know, he did it for 4 years. He knows how to be a corrupt president effectively. And so what I worry about if there's a second Trump term is you're going to see more judges like Alito, more people who are just pure hacks who will do whatever their team wants. You're going to see fewer judges who are capable of independence. You know, I don't want to, you know, praise, say, Amy Coney Barrett too much. But, like, Barrett has shown more of an independent streak on the Supreme Court. And the reason why, I think, is she came up as a law professor. You know, she didn't come up through this, you know, I start off, you know, with a low-level political appointment, and then I gradually work my way up through Republican political appointments so that everyone in the Republican Party knows everything I believe, that I'm completely reliable. You know, she had her own career as an academic that she was perfectly happy with before she got picked to be a judge. And so, you know, someone like that who, you know, maybe like 20% of the time might do something a little surprising because, you know, they see the law as something other than their own, you know, a political project. Someone like that isn't going to get nominated in a second Trump term. In a second Trump term, we're going to have people who will do what Trump wants 100% of the time.
No, we're going to make patronage great again. I've been saying it for a while with this Project 2025 and his want to use this Schedule F to fire all the federal employees and bring in good loyalists. We're going to make patronage great again if that happens. And that's not good for, well, that's not good for any of us who haven't been thrown under the bus by Trump yet. Everyone will eventually get thrown under the bus. It's just a matter of when. But Ian, great piece. I hope folks will take a look at it over at Vox.com. The Republican Party's Man Inside the Supreme Court by Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent there at Vox. Ian, always great talking to you, man. Good stuff.
Thank you.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2003. That was the day that the U.S. Senate approved more than $300 billion in tax cuts over the next decade. The cuts barely passed. Vice President Dick Cheney cast the deciding vote 51-50. Starting in 2001, President George W. Bush proposed and pushed for a series of drastic tax cuts. The administration promised the changes would help to create jobs and grow the economy. But the results fell far short of that goal. 10 years after the massive tax cuts, the Washington Post ran a story analyzing their impact. The article stated, quote, by any measure, the Bush tax cuts have benefited the wealthy more than the middle class. The top 20% of earners received 73% of the tax relief. The bottom 20% only received 1%. Coupled with spending on wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the tax cuts sent the national debt soaring. And those promised jobs? They never materialized. 2001 to 2007 marked the worst period of job growth since the 1950s. Then, in 2008, the recession wiped out 8 million jobs. Many of the Bush tax cuts were designed to sunset or expire after so many years. Yet, when it came time for the cuts to end in 2010, Republicans in Congress fought to keep them going. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka declared, "It is absolutely insane that in these tough economic times, some people want to continue George W. Bush's tax giveaways to millionaires. Working families are losing their jobs, their benefits, and their homes. They are the ones who need help." The Bush tax cuts finally expired in 2013, although new legislation repackaged and continued many of them. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So Benny sent me an email yesterday that caught my attention. He said, "Rick, I heard your discussion on belief versus reality and couldn't agree with you more. Since I came across this Harris Guardian poll, I thought you might find it interesting. How does something like this happen? Why do we allow it to happen? And what can we do to change it?" And that becomes the question on a lot of these issues that we find ourselves divided on. Understand, the corporate-controlled mainstream media is all about dividing us. It's all about getting us into our camps. It's all about us throwing bombs at each other and never really realizing that the garbage that they're feeding us, not good for us. And what I talked about is the reality that for most people, the economy's doing okay. You ask them, "Hey, how are you doing?" The majority of people are going, I'm doing okay. I'm making it. I'm doing well. I'm a little angry about prices. I'm a little angry about this. But hey, the kids aren't going hungry. They're not walking bare feet down the street. Getting to work. Things are going okay. Now, what's interesting is Benny sends me this poll, this Harris Guardian poll, that says 55% of the people that they polled believe the economy's shrinking. And 56% think the U.S. is experiencing a recession right now, even though the broadest measure of the economy, the gross domestic product, has been growing. Things are growing. Now, it may not be trickling down. This is one of those things where you go, yeah, here's something to be angry about. Maybe the one guy at the top, maybe the guy who owns all the shares and all the best land and all the big companies, maybe them taking all of the cookies and leaving nothing but crumbs, or maybe some crumbs, maybe that's something to be angry about. This poll also says 49% of people believe the S&P 500 is down for the year, though the index went up about 24% in 2023 and is up more than 12% this year. 49% believe that unemployment is at a 50-year high. And I'm going, really? How can you believe that? Even though unemployment has been under 4% at near 50-year lows. So how is it possible that up is down and right is left and dry is wet? How is that possible? Well, according to this, everyone's blaming Biden for the economy. 58% polled said the economy is worse due to mismanagement from the president. It's all his fault. He's got the switch. And you go, explain that. Because the economy has gotten better over the last couple of years. And if you remember, 4 years ago, we were shut down. So this idea that, everything was wonderful under Trump, not so much. Now there's opportunity. Here's the thing. I came across a Navigator research poll that points out that, look, Americans do understand that things are the things that are wrong, we can fix. There's a chance here. Their poll, 58%, they want to crack down on corporate price gouging. That's how you fix some of our inflation problems. Go after the profiteers, the gougers. 53% say, hey, we need to figure out how to rein in the cost of health care and prescription drugs. That a good chance, something we should be doing. 45% think we should be making it easier to buy or rent a place to live. These are policy things that we can get our hands around, things, opportunities for the Biden administration to go out and say, we're doing some stuff. We're making lives better and easier. But here's the thing, and this is the reality, Benny, and I hate this. The mainstream corporate controlled media wants you miserable. Negative sells. Dirt sells. Anger sells. If you're mad, if you're ticked off, you're going to tune in and you're going to talk about it and you're going to regurgitate it. The clickbaiters, they want you angry and upset because what? You're going to share it. You're going to see how bad? And we get this confirmation bias. You believe the economy's bad. You search out all this information that says, hey, the economy's bad. And then we buy it. Got to tell you, we got a lot of work to do, folks. And it starts with what you're consuming. Tune out with the fake news, all the right-wing outrage, folks. Get rid of that. Get that misery out of your life. Seriously. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. How are things in your world? I want to know. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Also, freespeech.org for the video component. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.